Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is the Jack Pod, where On Point news analyst Jack Beatty helps us connect history, literature, and politics in the way that brings his unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
We're at episode 26, Jack. What's your headline?
What leopard?
Indeed, what leopard are you talking about, Jack?
Well, here is a parable by Franz Kafka that'll explain that. Leopards break into the temple and drink up the offering in the chalices. This happens again and again. Finally, one can predict their action in advance, and it becomes part of the ceremony. Of course, that's talking about the inexorable tendency to normalize the abnormal, tolerate the intolerable. And Jonathan V. Last of the Bulwark ties it to former President Trump by saying, you know, he's conditioned us to expect nuts. Nuts is normal with Trump. And the question is, how did that come to be? And here is a tiny anecdota, a little in the myriad of possible answers to that. Here is one little data point. Chris Hayes. He's an extremely talented journalist. He has a show on MSDNC, as Trump calls it. And he is extremely bright. Indeed, he may be the only television host in history to use the word, the phrase, under-theorized. He said of something, it's under-theorized. Wow, that's smart. Anyway, Chris Hayes, through a lot of the Trump years, not all of them, but some of them, he would not say Trump's lies were lies. And the reason was, he said, we don't know anybody's motive. You know, we can't get inside somebody. And it's only fair to say, you know, their deceptions, their prevarications, their inaccuracies, but we can't go to lie. Well, the leopard got into the temple, put a paw into the temple on that one, because they were lies. And Chris Hayes, as so many journalists, simply was reluctant to go to lie, even when there was a fire hose of lies every time Trump opened his mouth. That's an example of how the leopard put at least one paw into the temple. And of course, another reason that nuts is norm is there's so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, Joe Klein writes, brings a, quote, new vomitation of crazy from Trump. But it's our Mark Twain, James Carville, who this week relieved the gloom with this lightning flash of wit. Said Carville, choosing which Trump bit of crazy to single out, you feel like a mosquito at a nudist colony.
I should not laugh at that, because we are talking about the fate of America here. But yeah, only James Carville, the raging Cajun, could come up with that.
Come up with that one. Well, you know, writing in The New Yorker, Susan Glasser says, if you only see clips from Trump's speeches, you his lunacy can be dismissed. It's just, well, background noise and so on. She says, to get the whole effect, you have to watch a whole speech. And so this week, she looked at a speech in Georgia. I looked at the same speech. It's from last week, and watched nearly the 2 hours of it. And the question is she right? Does Trump seem to me crazier and or more dangerous than before? I watched the whole speech. Well, stay tuned for the sequel.
Okay, because that's exactly what we're going to do, Jack. I mean, you've identified major portions of the speech for us to go through to get to your conclusion if in watching the entirety of a Trump rally, you come to any other summary than, the leopard is very firmly inside the temple. Where would you begin your analysis?
Well, with the beginning, this is how a Trump rally begins.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
Now, Jack, to be honest, the anthem and the pledge are things that I've said thousands of times in my life. So what's the problem with starting a presidential rally or a campaign rally, I should say, with that?
The problem is who the singers are. These are the people convicted, some of them, for trying to overthrow the government on January 6th.
These are the insurrectionists?
These are the insurrectionists.
There's an insurrectionist choir?
Yeah, it's not the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. It's the insurrectionist Washington, D.C. jail choir. And Trump has, of course, made them, stars of the show. They are martyrs, and so that's how he begins. And he flows in. He before he comes on, you hear his voice reciting the pledge while the banner is intoned by the convicts. Quite a moment.
I would like to just repeat this again so that I'm clear on what you said. There's a choir of currently incarcerated insurrectionists who attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, in order to stop the peaceful transition of power in the United States. And Donald Trump is beginning his presidential campaign rallies with these people singing the national anthem.
He is. And he goes a step, he went a step farther this week in a speech in Vandalia, Ohio. And I would commend to anybody an article by our friend Tim Schneider, the Yale professor, the historian of fascism and Nazi Germany. His article is entitled "The Bloodbath Candidate," and the subtitle is "In Context, Trump is Worse." Of course, this alludes to Trump's comment about, "Well, there'll be a bloodbath if I lose the election," and immediately the people who wanted to, don't look at that leopard, kept saying, "Oh, like for example, the Persuasion, that website." They said, "Oh no, he's talking about automobiles. He's not talking about he's not talking about a bloodbath if he loses the election." Au contraire, says Tim Schneider, who points out something really new here. In Vandalia, not only does the Star-Spangled Banner, the convicts singing that, but Trump says, "Please rise for the horribly and unfairly treated January 6th hostages." So people stand up for the hostages. And Trump goes on to say that he's going to pardon them on the first day of office, and he's signaling, as Schneider says, that violent criminals who tried to get him into office are going to be pardoned. And if you're violent to try to get me into office, come in November, I'll pardon you too. That's the bloodbath promise. And he goes on in this same speech to make martyrs of the January 6th coup prisoners. And Schneider finishes. He says, "We should see Trump for what he is, an aspiring fascist who likes, wants, and needs violence."
Okay, Jack. So that is, that's a lot, but that's just the beginning of Trump's rally. last week. What then after that specifically caught your attention as he got the Trumpian snowball rolling?
Yeah, well, in between the beginning and the end comes a bulging midriff of words arranged according to this principle. I'll say any darn thing that pops into my mind. You could almost call it my terminally distracted mind. And here he is.
Yeah, I gotta interrupt. You know, the fake news will say, oh, he goes from subject to, no, that's, you have to be very smart to do that. You got to be very smart. It's called, you know what it is called? Spot checking. You're thinking about something when you're talking about something else, pop, 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 and then you get back to the original, and they go, holy, do you see what he did? That's something. It's called intelligence.
I mean, Jack, at least Trump is showing some self-awareness here that people have the very criticism of him that you're highlighting now.
Yes, it was very shrewd. It was about, an hour in, and I think he must have sensed that these he was having one digression after another. He must have sensed that people were needed to understand what was going on. So he labels it superior intelligence, creativity. And here's an example of just what he's talking about, this interruption. His divagation on Biden at the beach and, wait for it, Cary Grant.
Somebody said he looks great in a bathing suit, right? And you know, when he was in the sand and he was having a hard time lifting his feet through the sand, because, you know, sand is heavy. They figured 3 solid ounces per foot. But sand is a little heavy. And he's sitting in a bathing suit. Look, at 81, do you remember Cary Grant? How good was Cary Grant, right? I don't think Cary Grant, he was good. I don't know what happened to movie stars today. We used to have Cary Grant and Clark Gable and all these people. Today we have, I won't say names because I don't need enemies. I don't need enemies. I got enough enemies. But Cary Grant was like Michael Jackson once told me, the most handsome man, Trump, in the world. Who? Cary Grant. Well, we don't have that anymore. But Cary Grant at 81 or 82, going on 100, this guy, he's 81 going on 100. Cary Grant wouldn't look too good in a bathing suit either. And he was pretty good looking, right?
Wow.
What can you say? In fact, you know, as to Cary Grant, in a famous New Yorker profile long about 1980, Pauline Kael goes to visit him. He was around 80 then. And he's swimming in his pool, and he comes out of the pool, Cary Grant does, and greets her. And her first line is something like, Cary Grant is remarkably hale. And she goes on to say just how great he looks at age 80. So there's a little footnote of trivia to this incredible digression on Biden at the beach and Cary Grant.
You know what really seizes me about that digression, Jack, is that it has absolutely nothing to do with what Trump claims he can bring back to the White House that would make people's lives better. I mean, it's just pure schoolyard taunting. But his masterful way of doing that taunting is extremely effective with his base.
Oh, it is. It is. It's mocking, and he's having a good time while he was doing it. And while his mind was, you know, furnishing the image of Cary Grant, he went to that and by way of Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't make something like that up.
Oh, you can't. And by the way, just because, I mean, we have to try to do a little fact checking as we go along. When he says that they say sand is 3 ounces a foot, I will have everyone know that that cannot possibly be true because a foot is a unidimensional measurement. In order to have weight, you have to be measuring in 3 dimensions. So there.
Ah, God, that's
like a foot of sand that's 50 feet deep would be way more than 3 ounces. Okay, I'm grasping at straws here, but that is a fact. Now, Jack, next part of this Georgia speech that you wanted us to listen in on.
Yeah, well, throughout, Trump conjures the nightmare of America under invasion by the world's offscourings, you know, the wretched of the earth, surging across the border that he says Joe Biden has intentionally left wide open. And in this bite of this from the speech, he goes right at the economic anxiety of Americans who have most to fear from, quote, cheap foreign labor.
Virtually 100% of all jobs created under Biden have gone to foreign-born workers. How do you feel about that? Good?
Okay, well, that's what Donald Trump claimed, obviously, in that speech last week. But here are the facts, and it's very, very important to to put to rest this falsehood, this lie that Trump is saying, because the truth is that since Joe Biden's inauguration, there has been an increase of 6.2 million jobs, an increase of 6.2 million jobs for native-born Americans. So, Jack, I mean, you wanted us to talk about this particular statement of Trump's for a reason, and why is that?
Because it's so preposterous, and because Trump should not, he lives in a glass house when it comes to creating jobs. And let's put it in context, partly because of the pandemic, maybe mostly because of it. Trump is the only president since Herbert Hoover who ended his tenure with fewer jobs in the country than when he began. It's not a record to boast of. And of course, Trump wouldn't bring up the exonerating context for anybody else, but we will mention that there was a pandemic.
Mm. Okay, so then, but this, you know, when speaking of jobs and the economy, Trump often says he was good for everybody, but especially he claims the Trump presidency was good for Black and Hispanic Americans. Did he make mention of that in Georgia?
He did, and he went right to something we've covered on this program, the understandable resentment. We focused on Chicago. It's true elsewhere. Of African-American and Hispanic Americans to the devotion of resources to the surge of asylum seekers. Mayor Adams of New York has said, you know, this immigration will destroy New York City, and he's had to cut funding for the schools and other things. Again, Trump goes right to this idea of who's going to suffer most from this invasion by immigrants.
In February alone, nearly 1 million jobs held by native-born Americans disappeared by one. Think of that. You lost 1 million jobs. Black people, that's who lost the jobs. Hispanic people, that's who lost the jobs. That's why we just had a poll come out. Now, it doesn't sound great, but it is great relative. You know, a guy, a stiff like Mitt Romney, I think he had 4% of the black vote. I had, as of this poll today, Marjorie, 28%. If that's the case, this election is over.
Once again, to provide some context here, when Trump speaks of February alone, that is actually a month where jobs for native-born Americans did go down in that one month, but it was 500,000, not 1 million. So, Jack, here's the thing. You wanted us to go through these different parts of the totality of a Trump speech in order to, you know, to get back to your headline, to see just how far and how permanently the leopard, as Kafka put it, has, you know, become at home in the temple, that nuts is normal. You know, I have to say, maybe these parts that we picked are the wrong ones. I don't know, because it seems normal for Trump is what I want to say, Jack. And maybe we've just been in the Trump normal world for so long that it doesn't seem out of the ordinary, the things he said, Jack.
Susan Glasser says, you know, watch the whole speech and you'll see the danger and craziness of this guy. I disagree. This speech did not restore the leopard's warning growl to me. For one thing, it was so, 2 hours of it, so boring. I'd rather watch paint dry. And second, he was enjoying himself. This wasn't the grim Trump. And for a man facing, you know, 91 felony indictments, accounts, and possibly the loss of his fortune to, you know, and indeed, he may lose Trump Tower on Monday if he can't pay back the ill-gotten gain of $500 million to the state of New York. He may lose Trump Tower. Yet you'd never know it looking at him. He's blithe. He's having fun. He's talking Cary Grant. And then the third thing that makes him less menacing is his naked insecurity. His lack of confidence. It just comes out again and again. For example, Viktor Orban, he has a section on that, visits him, the Hungarian quasi-dictator. And he goes right to what's important about Viktor Orban. He said, I should be the country would be much better off if Trump were president. Then he says, points that out. He went on an excursus about The Apprentice, the program that used to be, he hosted on, and he taught, and he revealed in this how potentially jealous he was that Arnold Schwarzenegger would succeed as the new host, replacing Trump, who left to run for president. And he even talked about a dialogue he had with the important person at NBC saying, look, I don't want Schwarzenegger to do well on this. And he said, and I was really glad when he didn't. Again, the lack of just basic self-confidence, the need to boost himself. And even in these anecdotes, he's showing how vulnerable he is. He was worried that Arnold would put him in the shade. So I don't agree with Susan Glasser. He doesn't seem to me, he seems, in this speech at least, more pathetic than menacing and, frankly, more ludicrous than either.
Okay. Well, you know, in that case, I actually want to use your headline today about what leopard as the question for Jack Potters, okay? Because do you think that Donald Trump's many years now on the public political stage has led to a normalization of the sort of fire hose of lies and delusions that he, he spits out during one of his rallies? I mean, has that language and that alternative reality become normalized for us? Or do you think, as Jack says, that the more you listen actually to Trump, the more you hear his vulnerabilities? So those are the questions that I want to know from Jack Potters, or the answers I want to know this week, especially because your answers will help us better understand what impact Trump continues to have and his language continues to have on all of us as Americans. So you know what to do. Go to the On Point Vox Pop app if you've already got it. If you don't, just look for On Point Vox Pop wherever you get your apps and let us know what you think about this week's Jackpod. So, Jack, when we come back, we're going to hear from some folks about last week's Jackpod. And we got some pretty strong rebuttals to your theory of presidents and the Xanadu effect. Are you ready for that, Jack?
I'm ready.
Okay, so we'll hear it in just a moment.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
Well, we're back. And Jack, last week you talked about the Xanadu effect and how presidents can get very tightly insulated away from reality. And we got a lot of response from Jack Potters. Almost all of them were in agreement with you about the cosseted nature of the Oval Office. But we got this awesome rebuttal, and I'm going to play the whole thing today. This awesome rebuttal from Joe in Los Angeles.
Hi, Migda and Jack. This is Joe in Los Angeles. I was thrilled to hear my comments on the air last week and honored to be included in the company of my fellow Hoosier Howard from Elkhart and all the other intelligent and thoughtful callers featured on your show. I am particularly grateful to Meghna for her persistent American optimism. I will hold her to that come November. As for this week's question of the Xanadu effect on American presidents, of course presidents are shielded from reality. The rewards for success in any competitive endeavor are so overweighted relative to their actual contribution to the human condition that the most successful are not necessarily the most talented or the most gifted, but rather the most obsessed with reaching the highest levels of their particular field. If you are obsessed enough to become the president of the United States, you did not get that far by having a shred of doubt or even allowing doubt to be in the same room with you. That is, you have surrounded yourself with people who know exactly what you want to hear from your earliest days. Our presidents do not give in to the Xanadu effect while in office. They sit down behind the Resolute in January, already suffering from chronic, late-stage, long Xanadu. Thanks both, and have a great week.
I love Jack Potter's Jack so much. First of all, Joe, absolutely, I will go to my grave with undying American optimism, so thank you for noting that. But he was making an excellent point, Jack, about, you know, there's that adage about, you know, anyone who, the person who most, who really should be president is a person who would never want to run for the office, right?
Yes,
I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, you know, I love long Xanadu. That is just
late stage long Xanadu.
Yeah, late stage Xanadu, and certainly in the case of Joe Biden, think of the Senate all those years, my learned colleague from Delaware, all that deference and the effect it has. Yeah, I mean that is a tough thing to shake off. There are cases though. I'm thinking of Mike Pence. The night that Trump was elected in 2016, this has been reported, Mrs. Pence, I'd forgotten her first name, I'm sorry, looked at him and reportedly clenched, anyway, angry, and said, "Well, you've got what you wanted," and walked away. So Mrs. Pence was not getting into the Xanadu effect there. And you know, with Lyndon Johnson, Lady Bird, he was debating whether to run for president again in 1968, and naturally the clack around him was saying, "Well, yeah, the jobs depended on it. You know, go ahead, Mr. President." And Lady Bird said, "Lyndon, remember President Wilson? Last year and more of his tenure, he had a stroke, and he was just sort of going through the motions of running the country." She didn't add that his wife and physician pretty much ran the country, which, if it were a substitution for Lyndon Johnson, I'd take Lady Bird any day. Anyway, he listened to her. She didn't get inside Xanadu. And so people can pierce the bubble. But it's the daring aide who'll try to play Cassandra with bad news. As I say, the sort of model for the courtier who tells bad news is the guy who told Peter the Great that his army had lost a battle, and Peter said, "Strangle that guy."
By the way, it's Karen Pence, just so we do her justice.
Yeah. Yes.
I just have to make the painfully obvious observation, Jack, that the two examples you brought up were of the women married to the men in the office. So sense does prevail, but oftentimes not for the person who's occupying the office. Okay, so anyway, we have some more. There was this interesting observation from Miles Allison in Austin, Texas.
So my parents have been coddled against reality. They've been indoctrinated by Fox News. That is, until they had to incur the cost of nursing home care for my grandfather, and now they have a more progressive view of socialized medicine. So I guess there's progress that can be made.
Xanadu can be broken down by the horrors of actually some of the realities of living in the United States. I actually feel for Miles's parents there. But there's one more regarding last week, Jack, that I want to play for you because we had this Jack Potter send us a message of very strong disagreement with you, Jack. Here's Chris Sontheimer from Glendale, California, who says he's your fan, but...
But I'm tired of the constant belittling of Biden from the left. And no one's perfect, but as far as candidates go, he's the best pro-labor president we've had since Kennedy. He's feeding our children, and he ended that money grab called the Afghan War. But we're in a fight for our country, and if the left believes it, we need to start acting like it, because it's going to be the independents that we need to win over, because they're the ones who are going to win this election.
So, Jack, you're going to stop trashing Joe Biden?
Oh, gosh. Well, I guess I don't see it as my job to do, you know, either boost or trash him. I was citing Biden because I do think that I was thinking particularly of the New Yorker profile of him recently by Evan Osnos. And Osnos speaks of the almost preternatural calm in the White House. I think he calls it the sedative feeling. The people aren't alarmed, that they're not getting, you know, we're going to do fine. In other words, I don't know that the Biden people feel quite as urgent about this election as Chris does, or at least the president has started to act that way, vigorous State of the Union, he's out on the campaign trail, but do they really get what's at stake? Are they acting that way? What could Biden do? Well, you know, look at the Democratic bench, the governor of Pennsylvania, looking at all the qualifications for jobs in the state. He said, wait a minute, we don't need college diplomas for all this stuff, Governor Shapiro said. Anybody can apply for these jobs. What's going to stop Biden from saying that about the federal civil service? Now, maybe he can't do it legislatively, but say it. Say something like that. Something dramatic, something up to the moment. They haven't done it yet, and I think part of the reason is Xanadu.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, there's one more set of Jack Potter comments that I want to touch on today. It actually has to do with something from a couple of episodes ago, because Jackpot listeners keep wanting to go back to this. You remember, so here it is. This is this comment that we heard from Chris in California at the beginning of this month.
When are we going to start calling these people stupid? And I don't mean to be vulgar, but I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. We're becoming the laughing stock of the world.
Okay, so that was when Chris was using a bleepable word to describe Donald Trump's voters who are in his base. And I said, don't do that. That is exactly the kind of disrespect that is the cause of a deep-seated grievance in many Trump voters. And so people are still really riled up about this, Jack. They're actually riled up with my vigorous disagreement with Chris. So, for example, here's Tom from Iowa City.
And truth is, he's correct. And I work with a lot of these people. And the crazy part is, when you try to tell them they're stupid, they get offended. And that's kind of why you were worried about, you know, airing that. You don't want to offend the dumb people. But they're the same people that call Democrats snowflakes. But then once you call them out on their BS, they melt and they can't handle it. And they don't even recognize the hypocrisy.
Okay, so here's the thing, Jack. Since I'm the host, I get to choose how we end every episode of the Jackpod. And this is for Joe, actually. I'm going to choose to end on my indefatigable American optimism. This time it's actually voiced by none other than Howard, the man with the view from Elkhart, Indiana, who actually just disagrees with the insult calling and believes that change is possible.
There are even positions that I believe that, given the facts, I would change my belief, or that the dumb person, given facts, won't change their belief. There are some out there like that, but I do believe that the vast majority of us, given true facts, will believe true facts. It's just a matter of educating the people for that.
Okay, Jack, what do you think?
Howard, again, our wise man on the Wabash out there. I agree with that. People, you know, are corrigible by reality. We just heard about parents who were facing, putting someone in a nursing home and coming right up against the limits of the American welfare state. It ends with at the nursing home door, and that's a piece of reality that can penetrate. But to penetrate, it requires that people, a very hard thing, admit they were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to admit you're wrong.
For anyone.
And they were wrong. They were wrong voting for Trump. They have, at some level, they have to know it. Everybody does. It's a tough one. I mean, you've got to, and then there's this socialized effect. Your friends are in the cult, your relatives, and you can't. And as we heard on an earlier program, in fact, I think our first program, Trump voters have had to sacrifice a lot to support him in terms of ostracism, in terms of scorn, in terms of family members breaking contact. They have suffered for Trump. That's an investment. That's a sunk moral cost in sustaining Donald Trump. So I think it's so hard to get people to change. And there's a Kierkegaard quote that crystallizes this. He says, "How can I be myself in the presence of the truth?"
Wow.
You know, identity comes before truth.
Wow. Okay, once again, everyone, Jack just remembered that Kierkegaard quote spontaneously, with no notes. Right out, it just came out of his mind. Oh, I'm telling you, Jack, one of these days, I'm going to insist the jackpot just be, like, how do you have such a fantastic memory? But anyway, with that, Jack, thank you, as always.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpot from On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.